When we ran out of time yesterday, we were still working in the book of Proverbs with some various proverbs of King Solomon. So I want to turn back to Proverbs chapter 24, verse 30, and finish up one last proverbial thought before we move on to a different piece of wisdom literature. So you've had your little notebook, I hope, all this time to jot down the references of proverbs that you feel would benefit you, or maybe that you could pass on to somebody else to memorize and use in their tackling of the troubles of life. The last one that we look at is a proverb about laziness and how, left unchecked, it will lead to difficulties for an individual and for people associated with that individual. Remember, these proverbs are targeted specifically against adolescents as they're kind of learning their life skills, but also can be utilized by those who just have not been living a mature life. So listen to this advice that he gives. I passed by the field of a sluggard, so a lazy person, not somebody that's got issues that make it difficult to work, but somebody that could physically do the work, just doesn't really want to do it. By the vineyard of a man lacking sense, because the person we're talking about is not thinking through the need to do work. Behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. So this is an agricultural period where families had a family farm, the house was situated on it, they were growing their own crops. And so if you did not take care of those things, the weeds took over. And if you didn't keep your property boundaries maintained, the walls would break down and animals could wander in and eat your crops. And so that's the situation brought on by the laziness of this person. And Solomon makes this observation. Then I saw and considered it. I looked and I received instruction. A little sleep, little slumber, little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber and want like an armed man. So the last thing that he mentions here are things that happen to you. You can get attacked, and people can steal your stuff. But laziness, the desire to just lay around and be completely at ease and not take any efforts to work on projects, that is your own fault. That causes you to lose your stuff. And so Solomon does not want to see any of his young people or the readers of these proverbs to fall into that self-destructive behavior. Now, Proverbs chapter 25 begins with this little heading. It says, "These also are proverbs of Solomon, which the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah, copied." And the reason we're going to go ahead and leave the book of Proverbs at this time is because of that verse. It would appear that a couple of hundred years after King Solomon first issued this book of Proverbs we've looked at up to this point, Hezekiah arose as one of his descendants and became a revivalist king. He didn't like the sin and bad behavior and bad attitudes that had crept into the nation over the years. And he determined that it was time to return to the fear of the Lord, because that's the beginning of knowledge. That's the beginning of wisdom. And it appears as if King Hezekiah reissued the original book of Proverbs with this additional section to it that has other proverbs of Solomon that he was able to chase down in his pursuit of wisdom. And I believe that maybe, in addition to these extra Solomon proverbs, Hezekiah found a few other helpful proverbs which he appended at the tail end of the book, perhaps even something that he learned from his own mother. So we're going to save Proverbs chapter 25 all the way through 31 until we get to the kingdom of Hezekiah. So just kind of file it away in your brain for later. At this point, we're going to go to the book called The Song of Solomon or The Song of Songs. So you turn for that, turn to that in your own Bible. And I'm going to kind of give you the introductory material that we need to talk about. This project that we're on, the fifth time through the inspired Word of God, I've been following through the English Standard Version of the Bible. However, the English Standard Version, when it deals with the Song of Songs, while it divides it up into the different speakers, I don't think it necessarily hits all the proper division points. And so I am going to revert back to some work that I did when we were going through this in the New American Standard 1977 edition. So I've got my printed pages right in front of me here. This book appears to be what I would call an opera. Now, operas are technically something that we think of with European, much more modern time period, where singers sing the story back and forth. We don't know that opera exactly like that existed in the ancient times, but something similar to it may have. Something very more basic than that. Now, during the Greek period, the high point of Greek culture, they did plays, tragedies, comedies, and they had people speaking back and forth, sometimes only one person on the stage, maybe a couple of people. And then they would have a group called the chorus, which would interject in certain points of the play, the emotion of the moment, or some sort of setting of the stage or the background, maybe giving some backstory for the characters. And so we're going to see that kind of situation come up in this book as well. But it predates Greek drama by several centuries, because we're talking about the 10th century BC for Solomon. So I believe that we will have two main singers, because it is clearly a song. Its name is the Song of Songs. So we'll have two clear singers. The one is a woman who appears to be young and employed in the service of King Solomon. I'll explain more about that when we get to the text itself. And then there is her opposite number, her lover, the man she is just taken with and who is taken with her. And this man also is in the employ of King Solomon, taking care of animals. And this opera follows the blossoming of their love affair, where they are just wanting to be in each other's presence and spending time with each other in special circumstances. And then eventually they get married. There's some difficulty that comes up. I think that's kind of an interesting aspect of this. But they resolve that. And I think the final part of the book is where maybe they're in their older years and still pledging their love and still expressing their desire to be with each other. So when I talk to kids about this and we're going over the content of the Bible books, I say, Song of Solomon, it's a love story. Because it is. And it is problematic to the church. And problematic before that to some of the Jewish leadership, some of the Jewish scholars, because there are places in this book that are exceptionally, exceptionally explicit sexually. And that is bothersome to a lot of believers. It, I guess, kind of embarrasses them. And so it's been the habit in both the Jewish teaching period and in the Christian teaching period to try to allegorize this, to make this much more spiritual. And so they try to make, in the Old Testament period studies, this is all about God's love for Israel and Israel's love for God. And then in the New Testament period and in the church period, the teachers would try to make this all about Christ's love for the church and the love of the church for Christ. And while I appreciate their attempt to make this a spiritual book, they still have the problem of these sexually explicit passages. I mean, do you really want to think about God making love to Israel, God the Father making love to Israel, or Jesus the Son making love to the church? And yet that is part of this book, which is why, by the way, this is going to be a PG-13 section in our study through Scripture. So for the next several days, moms, dads, babysitters, you'll need to occupy the younger children with something else and maybe save this for a little bit more private time for your own studies. All right, so I just want you to know that my take on this is I believe that this is just a book, an opera intended to celebrate the passionate romantic love between a man and a woman during the early, prosperous, and peaceful years of King Solomon's kingdom. One of the things that happens when you're living in a peaceful culture and living in a culture that is well-to-do is art has a chance to kind of just explode. The temple, for example, and the palace built by King Solomon were examples of physical artwork, the making of all sorts of beautiful images and tapestries and carvings and a great big majestic building design. So that flourished during the early part of King Solomon's reign. And so I would expect there to be the flourishing of the more I guess esoteric arts like Proverbs, for example, which is produced by Solomon, or maybe some of the Psalms that were produced by those after the time of David in the early time of King Solomon. So I believe this is just a product of that same sort of thing. The writer of this, which I don't believe is Solomon, is just wanting to express the special joy that there exists between a man and a woman as they fall in love and as they develop that relationship and as they go through the troubled times of it and then finally come to that situation of balance of, I love you and you're my best friend and I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Because that is God's plan. God's original design was one man, one woman together for an eternity at the very beginning, but certainly after death came into the world, until one of them died. The New Testament in the book of Hebrews says that marriage is to be honored by all, and the marriage bed, which is a reference to the sexual interaction between a husband and a wife, is undefiled. And so there is nothing evil or wrong about sex. This has been problematic also in the teaching, particularly of certain groups or time periods in church history, where, and it's also true in Jewish history, by the way, that people got it in their head that sex's only purpose was to produce offspring. And so it wasn't to be enjoyed. It was a duty that just had to be done because you needed kids. That was never indicated by anything in Scripture. In fact, you can just look at the design of the human body made by God and see that God intended the sexual interaction between a man and a woman to be exciting and pleasurable and desirable and just plain fun. Let's just be honest about it. And the bodies fit together perfectly. The sexual organs are designed to intersect with one another in this magnificent way, with intense pleasure and climactic, orgasmic bonding between the husband and wife. Chemicals are pouring into the blood during the sexual activity that bonds a man to a woman. And that is why we teach what the Bible teaches, and that is you should remain abstinent from such sexual activities before you get married, until you get married to the one you're going to spend the rest of your life with. And then you bond and stay bonded only to him or her. And so, with all of that background, we are going to just enjoy this opera as it unfolds in front of us with this gift of romance and sexuality that God expects husbands and wives to enjoy. And so if you are a husband and wife, then I hope maybe this book will bring you joy. If you are not yet married, maybe it'll give you something to anticipate for once you find that special someone. All right, so chapter 1, verse 1, is the heading or the title to this book. And it says, The Song of Songs, which is a Hebraism, and it's actually an Middle Eastern phrase that means the ultimate song. So we know there's singing involved here, music involved. Too bad we don't have the musical score that goes with it. That would make this even more fun. But this is to be a special song. And then it says, which is Solomon's? And many, many, many commentators through the centuries, through the millennia, have assumed that that means Solomon wrote it. But it could just as easily mean it is dedicated to Solomon, which is not an uncommon practice, that an artist will dedicate his or her work to someone special, someone who has made it possible for these things to be put together. And that would certainly be true of Solomon. So I don't believe Solomon wrote it, and I don't believe he's a key player in it. He's mentioned a few times, but it's more that it's taking place inside the peaceful, prosperous kingdom of Solomon. So this needs to be divided up into various scenes to make good sense. And so the first scene, I believe, is a meeting between the lovers, between this couple that's developing a relationship of intense passion. And we start with the woman singing. And she's singing about what she's daydreaming over, what she wants to happen. Verse number 2. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your oils have a pleasing fragrance. Your name is like purified oil, and therefore the maidens love you. So the woman is daydreaming about kissing this man, saying that such kisses are better than drinking a fine wine. and that he smells wonderful to her. It was common practice, especially in times of prosperity, to not just simply put on olive oil as a hygienic daily application, but to use scented olive oil. Because they didn't have deodorant sticks back at that time. They used scents to cover up the bodily odors that would naturally come through the day, which sometimes were a little sharp and maybe bothersome. So she says, I would love to kiss him. I want to kiss you. Your kisses are better than drinking wine, and you smell fantastic, and that's why all the other women around the kingdom are in love with you, just like I am. But verse 4, she says, draw me after you. Let's run together. So she wants to get alone with him and spend some quality time away. But then she says this, which I think has caused people to make a wrong assumption. It says, the king has brought me into his chambers. Now, many commentators believe that this is the opera about Solomon and a princess, and how in this phrase, he has brought her to the palace, into his personal bedchamber, as part of taking her as another one of his wives or concubines. But the woman is clearly a common worker, not a princess. That comes up very clear in the next singing that she does. And the man is not King Solomon, but rather a worker with flocks, which Solomon never did, and a worker apparently with the horses of Solomon. And so he is a common worker as well. So this is not the song of Solomon and a princess. It's the song of a woman and a man working for King Solomon. So the phrase here, the king has brought me into his chambers, means she's been hired on or drafted into service in the palace complex of King Solomon. And this is not all that hard to get our heads wrapped around. King Solomon's building this fantastically huge palace complex with large gathering areas because tons of people are going to be coming to Jerusalem on a regular basis from inside the kingdom, and they'll be staying overnight, and they're going to be eating. And there's also going to be foreign dignitaries that come in on a regular basis, and they're going to be staying overnight, and they're going to be eating. And so really, this palace has a component of it that is like a big first-class hotel and a great big five-star restaurant that's attached to it. And so you need workers in those positions. And so she, I believe, is saying that the king has brought me to work in his chambers. Maybe she's like a maid taking care of the guest rooms, because you've got to make the beds, you've got to wash the linen, you've got to start fires and put out fires and replace the fire material in the rooms. You've got to empty out chamber pots. That's their idea of inside toilets and all of the things that are needed for guest services in a great big classy hotel. So she seems to be involved in that. But she's also apparently involved in food services, making sure that the meals are served properly. And she's going to look good when she does that. And she's also going to be taking care of the animals that produce the milk and the cheese and the meat that are served on the menu. So this is not about her being brought to the king to be his wife or concubine, but rather she's being brought into his service. The next part of verse number 4 is the first time we hear from the chorus. Remember, in Greek drama later, the chorus set the stage, explained backstories and character development and emotions. The chorus is going to do a similar thing here, singing to the characters, the man and the woman. So here's what they sing first. We will rejoice in you and be glad. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. So they play off what she just said about the man, that your kisses are better than wine. And yes, the women that work in the palace, they love you. And they say, that's exactly right. Then the woman sings again. She says, I'm black but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Now, goats were typically black, and their hair was harvested and woven to make special material that would be used in tents, like the tents of Kedar, but also apparently around the palace. So she says, I've got this really dark complexion, which was unusual to some of the people she's working with because they are women that are not out working in the sun all the time. So they're more fair complected. So she sings, verse 6, don't stare at me because I'm swarthy, for the sun has burned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard. So she explains a little bit of her family background. She says, I know I'm dark, but don't give me that look. The reason I'm dark is because my big brothers, they made me go out and work in the vineyards, hours and hours in the hot summer sun and the blazing spring and fall sun. And even in the wintertime, I was out trying to tend things outside. So that's why I'm so dark. I didn't get a chance to take care of my own vineyard, which is what she uses to refer to her body. So right at this point, you can see she's a common worker, and she's from out of town, and she's a little different than her co-workers. And the big thing they have in common is they all think this other guy that she's in love with is handsome, and they'd all like to have him. Come back tomorrow, and we'll continue the opera.